I'm here on the job site with Dale, who's a framing contractor.
Hey, good morning.
Dale traded up to Geico Commercial Auto Insurance for all his business vehicles. We're here where he needs us most.
Yep, they sure are.
We make it easy for him to save on all his insurance needs, all in one place, with coverage that fits his business and bottom line. Oh, I shouldn't have looked down.
It's all right.
We're so far up here.
Look at me. Take a deep breath.
Oh, I'm good. So good.
Get a commercial auto insurance quote today at geico.com and see how much you could save. Get more with Geico.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, and Emory Education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Hello and welcome to the Full of Beans podcast, hosted by myself, Hannah, a registered associate nutritionist and your favourite crazy bean. Full of Beans is on a mission to reduce eating disorder stigma and increase eating disorder awareness. Together, we will establish inspiring conversations with a range of individuals, including those with personal experience and their loved ones, as well as clinicians, researchers, and charities who are all working to increase the understanding of eating disorders. Using my personal battle with atypical anorexia and body dysmorphia, as well as my master's in eating disorders and clinical nutrition, we will together explore the experiences of like-minded individuals who are equally as passionate about sharing their stories to increase the understanding of eating disorders. Please note that this podcast discusses sensitive topics and should not be seen as a replacement for evidence-based therapy or treatment.
Oh, before we start, how do I pronounce your surname?
I knew you were going to say that. So try to think of it as Ch, as in C-H.
Okay.
And Kelly.
Okay.
Chikelly.
Chikelly. Is that okay? Okay.
Yeah.
Today I am joined by Talia Chikelly, a registered dietitian and nutritionist who has her own private nutrition clinic, as well as working part-time in a private mental health hospital on a specialist eating disorder unit. Talia joins us today to discuss the role of an eating disorder dietitian, the importance of meal plans, and how to navigate the physical symptoms of an and how to navigate the physical symptoms of eating disorder recovery. Hello, Talia.
Hello, how are you, Hannah?
I'm good. Apparently I can't talk today. I'm really struggling to get my words out.
Yeah, and I just happened to giggle at that moment.
Yeah. I'll have to keep it all in now, otherwise there'll be random laughing, so people will know that I can't apparently talk today. It's so nice to speak with you. We've spoken a bit on the phone before, but not actually. Well, I mean, we're kind of face to face on Zoom. So it's really nice to have you on the podcast.
Yeah, thank you so much for inviting me onto your podcast.
Yeah, you're more than welcome. So I'm really excited to talk to you today about your clinic and the work that you do as a dietitian. And I guess the first thing I wanted to ask you was how you got into working as an eating disorder dietitian.
Yeah, absolutely. So I've worked as a dietitian for about 9 years, and six of those have been in the specialist area of eating disorders and disordered eating. So the first few years of my career was really just, you know, the bread and butter of dietetics. I worked in all throughout my career, I've worked as a clinical dietitian, and the first few years were in like aged care and rehabilitation. But then I had an interest in working in pediatrics, and I was really lucky to get a job in one of the largest teaching hospitals, pediatric hospitals in Sydney, in Australia, where I'm from. And on the very first day, my ward manager allocated me to the adolescent eating disorders unit. Mm-hmm. And up until that stage, I had no interest in working in eating disorders, but I absolutely loved it. I loved just being able to work in the multidisciplinary team and with the parents. And so that really kickstarted my interest in working in eating disorders. And then I was in that role for 2 years. And then after that, I found a few jobs. So I worked on an adult inpatient unit part-time, and then part-time at, this is all in Sydney, at the Butterfly Foundation, which is, I guess, the Australian equivalent of BEAT.
Okay.
So it's an Australian eating disorders charity, and part-time in a community role as well. And I did that for another year before moving over to London, working in a few locum roles, and then falling into my current role, so working part-time on an inpatient eating disorders unit in a private mental health hospital, as you mentioned in the introduction, and then part-time freelance, so running my business and my clinic.
So you're nice and busy.
Yeah, I am, yes.
And how does it compare doing the sort of stuff that you do in your clinic compared to the inpatient? Because I imagine they're quite different clients, I would imagine, that you work with as well.
Yeah, so it's really different stages of recovery. So on the inpatient setting, you know, the purpose of an inpatient admission is really for those that need more intensive treatment. So they might be more physically unwell or engaging in behaviours that are really impacting their physical and psychological health, really struggling with getting enough nutrition in. That's at a point that it is no longer able to be managed, or if, and what I mean by that is that it's no longer safe for the patient or client in the community, where they just need that extra support. So the types of patients that I see at the hospital, primarily it is for anorexia nervosa and bulimia nervosa, and those that are underweight and needing to weight restore. Mm-hmm. But we do have people who, you know, have other eating disorders or binge eating disorder that don't need to weight restore, that just need that more intensive support to really establish a regular pattern of eating and to reduce the behaviours that they're engaging in.
I imagine it's quite difficult, the sort of, does the treatment vary? You know, you said that the different stages of recovery, is it more in the hospital, more of like a trying to, you know, get people to, I don't want this to sound the way that it's going to sound, but it's sort of like ensuring that they follow that meal plan to get them up to a weight where they can then engage in like the psychology and stuff. And then I'm just assuming here, but then in your clinic, is it more like working around like the emotions around food and why those sorts of things develop?
Yeah, so I guess in my clinic, I see a really wide range, I guess, in terms of presentation. So I do work with people who are underweight. I do work with people who are at healthy weights for them, anorexia, bulimia, binge eating, and also people that fit into that OSFED category or that just have an unhealthy relationship with food and they don't have a clinically diagnosed eating disorder. So there are some people that I work with in my clinic who might actually benefit from more intensive treatment, like a daycare or inpatient setting that might be on a waiting list, or that they are actually able to make the change and progress in the outpatient setting, which is something that we always, you know, prioritize. We want people to be able to recover as much as possible in the home setting and the home environment. So I think it can be both in terms of establishing meal plans that can happen in both the inpatient and outpatient setting, but definitely in the inpatient setting, more so it will be establishing the very early stages of a meal plan, having the regular meals, regular snacks, and working up towards a meal plan that meets their nutritional goals. Because although most people are weight restoring, not everyone is. And it's important to note too that people, you know, don't just have to be underweight to be weight restoring, that we do work with people who are at a clinically, you know, categorized BMI that would place them in healthy or overweight or above categories that are weight suppressed, and they still need to restore their weight back to what's healthy for them. Same as in the outpatient setting. So it's just establishing that regular pattern of eating. And in the inpatient setting, we will do work on, you know, expanding variety and flexibility. We run social meal support groups where we take the patients out for supported meals, cafes and restaurants, which is a part of the job that I absolutely love.
That's fantastic.
But you are right in saying that there is, to a certain point, it is different for everyone, but we know that there is a certain point in terms of weight restoration that we can see a huge difference in someone's psychological health and being able to engage in the group program and the psychology input from their therapy team.
I think I just want to go back to something you said. I really liked the fact that you mentioned about the fact that you don't have to be underweight to then need to weight restore. I think there's quite a big stigma maybe attached that, you know, if you're at a healthy weight, then you don't need to gain any weight during your recovery because you are at a healthy weight anyway. But just because it's labelled necessary as a healthy weight on the BMI chart doesn't mean that it's your healthy weight. So I think it's fantastic that you recognise that. And I'm sure for the clients that you work with, that's a really refreshing thing to hear.
Yeah, I mean, I hope so. At the time, I think that it is probably hard to hear, but I, just through my experience, you know, working in this area for about 6 years now, the more that I've learned about, you know, weight stigma and, you know, internalized fat stigma as well, is that it is so important to be honest with clients who are recovering and on their recovery journey, and be really open and honest that, you know, the BMI is not something that can be used on an individual basis. And I think it's really important that treatment teams share that knowledge with patients and clients, because I know that, I think especially in the past, and maybe, you know, there's still some health professionals that are maybe not upskilled in the area, or GPs who may not be, you know, have that mental health training, that do use the BMI as a very set sort of criteria when they're trying to guide someone back to health and return of, you know, full health, which can really hold someone back from making full recovery.
Yeah, absolutely. And just as, I guess, a query, you know, because obviously a lot of doctors or whatever do use the BMI scale as, you know, that it was for your height is your healthy weight, how would you determine what someone's healthy weight is? Is it just that you want to get them to a point where they're not restrictive with their eating, and then wherever they fall, that's their healthy weight? Or do you have like other determinants of how you recognize that?
Yeah, so that's a really great question. So in eating disorders, I do agree that their BMI is needed for some people, and it is clinically indicated at certain stages of recovery. So especially when we are working with people who are severely underweight. So, you know, I'm talking about people who have very, very low BMIs that are at medically they're at risk and medically compromised. So we do use BMI criteria at the lower end to guide someone's weight restoration. And normally in practice, what we would do is we would assess someone's individual history. So we go right back through children, adolescents, what was their weight history for females and males? When did they hit puberty? What was their weight like at that time? When they finished growing, finding out about their weight history then, and then into adulthood. So we use that as a guide as well. That's particularly useful if someone developed their eating disorder or started to lose weight as an adult, because we know that if they had a really healthy relationship with food and exercise in their body, they would have settled at a healthy weight for them prior to the eating disorder. So we can use that as a gauge of, well, if that was healthy for you then, that's what we should be working to go back towards. So yeah, it's a combination of someone's history, looking at when physical parameters started to, I guess, reduce. So even looking at someone's cognitive function, any other sort of parameters like their bloods, you know, blood pressure, heart rate, periods stopping or returning. So looking at those sort of physical signs that the body says, hey, I'm not at a weight that's healthy for me, when things start to shut down. But usually when we look at using something like BMI, we look at the lower end of the healthy weight range as being a minimum of 20. Now that surprises a lot of people, because on the NHS, it is still recorded at BMI of 18.5. But we know that there are only, and this is in practice and in research, that there are only a handful of people that through eating disorder recovery will naturally fall at that lower range, because in order to stay at a BMI of 18.5, 19 for most people, they're still having to engage in unhealthy behaviours, you know, in terms of their diet and other compensatory behaviours. So we usually say a minimum BMI of 20, And then you can start to explore intuitive eating and challenging your food rules and beliefs. And that's where what you said came in. You know, the settling weight for someone is a weight where they're no longer engaging in restrictive eating and compensatory yeah. behaviors. So using, you know, in my practice, I use that BMI to sort of guide when we can start to, you know, come off a meal plan, start to be more intuitive, and then just see what happens. And it's all about learning to trust your body again.
Mm. Yeah, that's fantastic. I actually did a talk yesterday about nutrition in eating disorders, and I didn't, you know, I wanted to go on and be like, I wanted to give them what they wanted to hear, but actually I think that you've just said the key message. It's learning to trust your body, and there is no one size fits all. I want to ask you a question, and if it puts you on the spot, like, just don't worry. But if somebody's listening and they're very much like, well, the BMI is like, you know, it's completely true and everything, and I need to be a certain BMI, why maybe is BMI not as accurate as we might believe?
Yeah. Good question. So the BMI was created back in the 1800s by a mathematician, and it was, even back then, he said it was never intended to be used on an individual basis, and then it was not used in research until about the 1940s when the World Health Organization picked it up. But why it's also, you know, when you think about it with a really open-minded view, we have just two bits of data that we feed into a BMI, weight and height. Mm. So it doesn't account for our genetics, it doesn't account for our gender, it doesn't account for our age, our physical activity status, our body composition. These are all things that are so important when we think about someone's body weight and shape, because the number one thing driving someone's body weight and shape is genetics. So we can't possibly use weight and height only to determine health, because BMI is not an indicator of health, just like a number on a scale is not a determinant of health either. We have to look at the whole person and the whole picture.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, thank you so much for giving such that was such a excellent answer, and I was hoping that you were going to say something like that, not just say, oh, I don't know. So thank you. The other thing that I wanted to ask you, which you kind of spoke about earlier, which is what you do with clients, is meal plans during eating disorder recovery. I think we can all sit here and say obviously they're very important, but I think sometimes when you're in the depth of an eating disorder, it can be very difficult to stick to it or sort of know the importance of it. So from your perspective as a dietitian, why is a meal plan so important during that recovery stage?
Yeah, so in my experience, most people will benefit from some sort of meal plan in the early stages. Again, it depends on the type of eating disorder and the stage of their illness. And when I say meal plan, I don't mean this is what you... So in an inpatient setting, we have a very structured meal plan, which is this is what you eat, breakfast, lunch, dinner, and all of your snacks, which is pre-selected usually a week in advance in most hospital settings. In the outpatient setting, so in my clinic, for example, a meal plan doesn't look like that for most people. A meal plan is more so a template of what to eat in a day. So it's a guideline of portion sizes and the types of foods that is recommended to have. So meal plans are really important because when we look at normalizing someone's relationship with food, it is in almost like a three-phase approach is how I like to view it. So the first phase is ensuring that someone is eating regular meals and snacks and receiving adequate amounts of energy to meet their nutrition goals. So that's phase one, and that's really where a meal plan can be helpful in guiding someone to know what regular meals and adequate meals and snacks look like. The second phase, we're looking at adding variety and flexibility into someone's eating. So that's where you might start to move away from a meal plan slightly or start to add fear foods and challenge food rules and things like that, eating out, eating socially. And then the third phase is intuitive eating. So where meal plans can be really helpful is because often when someone has an eating disorder, their view of what normal eating is extremely skewed because of the restrictive diet, black and white mindset. So a meal plan is so important because it really helps to reestablish that idea of what normal eating is, and ensuring that someone has enough food, because we can't trust hunger and fullness cues in the early stages of eating disorder recovery. So something has to be there. And in the early stages, it often does have to be quite prescriptive, because we can't trust hunger and fullness cues. We can't, you know, it'd be very rare for me to meet someone and they agree to me adding juice or cake or biscuits into their diet. That needs to be a prescriptive part of someone's treatment plan, because these are the foods that are so often feared mm-hmm. in those early stages of eating disorder recovery.
Yeah. Yeah, I think I completely agree with you. I think it just gives that structure, and I really like what you said as well about the whole, you know, you're not able to recognise your hunger and fullness cues, and that's something that I've always sort of considered about intuitive eating is it's a fantastic concept, but I think sometimes people maybe start to do it too early in their eating disorder recovery when they're not necessarily ready to, I guess, know what their body needs. So having that prescriptive meal plan, I think, is a really good idea. And I guess a question would be, you know, I think it's difficult when you do have a meal plan, because sometimes, you know, it might be, okay, you need to have a snack now, but you're not necessarily, you don't feel like you are hungry. And then there can be quite a lot of intrusive thoughts. So how would you guide somebody through that in terms of making sure that they do stick to that meal plan and they don't get very upset about what thoughts are going on in their head?
Yeah, so it's really important in terms of educating someone as to why the meal plan is there, which is sort of what we covered earlier, and the importance of not being able to trust those hunger and fullness cues. So initially, because a lot of the bodily systems are suppressed due to being in a nutritionally deprived state, hunger and fullness hormones, the amount of enzymes that are needed for digestion, all of these things aren't there, so we can't trust hunger and fullness. So it's really important to reinforce that to someone, that you do have to eat to time initially, and you will have to eat when you are full. And one of the most common side effects that are reported to me is constipation, fullness, and bloating. And we have to think about why that might be, and that also impacts on the amount of food that someone feels comfortable with. So early satiety or gastroparesis, so that extreme feeling of fullness only after eating a small volume of food. If we left someone to eat according to their hunger when they're experiencing these gastrointestinal symptoms, we just wouldn't be able to get adequate nutrition in. So really important to remind people that due to being in a malnourished state, their digestive system is going to be impacted negatively, and they're going to experience these symptoms, and they're probably some of the hardest symptoms to overcome, because it's almost cruel. And I say this to the people that I work with, it's really cruel, because you're working so hard to recover, and yet your body is sending signals that it's in pain and it doesn't want to eat anymore, and you have to challenge that every single day. But unfortunately, the number one thing to help to reverse those side effects is to nourish the gut again and to weight restore, so that your gut function can return to normal. So I think it's reminding people of the importance of having that structure. And in terms of feelings of guilt and shame and lack of control that might be experienced, one thing that I try to get all of my clients to do is to start to reframe the thoughts that they're experiencing, and really trying to externalize the eating disorder self, because any change in weight or increase in dietary intake is going to be seen as bad from the eating disorder self. But we know that healthy self, so this is again, so externalizing the two, separating the eating disorder self and healthy self. Healthy self knows that weight restoration is required, that nourishing your body is required in order to get the life back that you know, you may previously been living. So to be able to go back to school or study, to be able to eat with, you know, socially with friends without feelings of guilt, to be more comfortable and more accepting of their body, you know, you need the nutrition to be able to engage in, you know, that form of therapy and be able to do that work. So definitely reframing thoughts and challenging that black and white mindset of good and bad foods, and replacing like moral values of food with something else. So if eating disorder self, you know, tries to feed that narrative or feed that lie that a food is bad or will make you fat or gain weight, really learning to challenge it. And it's really hard at the beginning. Some people say, you know, it's impossible to do, Talia, I can't do it, but it does come with practice. Is starting to think about food in a different way. So thinking about what value does that food have. So carbohydrates, for example, instead of thinking this food will make me fat, trying to reframe that to carbohydrates are an incredible source of energy and fiber, and the fiber is going to help, you know, my gut health. Or, you know, carbohydrates are part of a balanced diet, and, you know, I'm allowed to eat cake and I deserve to eat cake at social events. You know, just any sort of like reframe that is meaningful for that person.
Yeah, I think that's like really important. And just like speaking anecdotally, when I was going through my recovery, I'd often have those sorts of thoughts of, you know, you don't deserve that or whatever. Mm. And I found it so useful. I mean, people probably thought I was a bit cuckoo, but I just used to say it out loud, and saying it out loud, I was like, wait, I wouldn't say that to anybody else in my life, so why am I saying it to myself? And also just like, I think when you say it, when it's in your head, it seems rational, and then you say it out loud and you're like, that's actually so irrational, and you know, I do deserve all these things and that's absolutely fine. And why is it when we're going through recovery, because I know a lot of people complain of like IBS symptoms, you know, like bloating and stuff like that. Why is that? Why does that happen?
Yeah. So as I mentioned, it's one of the most commonly reported symptoms. So there was actually a study that looked at people in anorexia, a recovery from anorexia nervosa, done in America, and 95% of people reported gastrointestinal symptoms. Ah. So it is so common. And the reason why that is, I guess, is one of the main reasons is that when you are restricting your body of the energy that it needs, your metabolism starts to slow down. Mm-hmm. And what that means is that pretty much every body function, every system in the body will receive a little bit less energy than what it needs to function optimally. So it's as if you've got a rechargeable battery and it's running at, you know, 60 or 70%. So if we're trying to, you know, run a calculator, for example, the numbers on the screen might dim. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that might be one way to try and think about it. So things aren't working optimally. And that one of those things is your gut health. So the body tries to conserve energy in any way possible. So if it can spare X number of calories that are taken away from gut health to try and just keep all the vital functions running, then it's going to do that, because the body, the primitive brain, doesn't see digestion as being a bodily system that you need for survival. Mm-hmm. So it takes energy away from that. So mm-hmm. just the gut having less energy means that those muscles are going to become weaker. When people are following a restrictive diet as well, if they're not giving their body enough fuel and carbohydrates, the body will start to break down muscles in the arms, legs, and organs, and use that protein for energy. So there's two things there that are happening, and that leaves the muscles being very weak, losing tone, and those side effects being experienced. So the constipation, bloating, abdominal pain, really slow digestion. Some people do experience diarrhea as well, because the other thing that's happening, if the body's drawing away energy from the digestive system, the hormones that are used for digestion there's not enough of them being made, and also the enzymes that break down our food, there's not enough of them being made. So people actually end up with intolerances to certain foods because the gastrointestinal tract just cannot break the food down properly. So you end up with a bit of malabsorption in a way, and an intolerance to some foods. So IBS type symptoms are so common. Most of these will be able to reverse with adequate nutrition and weight restoration, though in my experience some people can have long lasting IBS type symptoms, really depending on how, I guess, malnourished the gut was and the impact that the restriction had on it long term.
Mm. Yeah, that's really interesting. I think often when we're in the depths of an eating disorder, you don't think about the long-term implications. And one thing that sprung to my mind immediately when you were talking about like enzymes and stuff like that was lactase. And I know a lot of people, you know, once they are recovered from an eating disorder or during recovery, that I can't have dairy because I get really bad IBS. Is, in your opinion, is that something that should be challenged? And if people want to start having dairy, is that something that, you know, could potentially come back and they could then have dairy? Or is it a sort of, you know, that that's an intolerance you've now got?
So we, so I always start off with, if someone can have dairy, that is my number one preference, just in terms of the nutritional quality that you get of dairy foods. But I do find that a lot of people are lactose intolerant when they are in the early stages of recovery. Now, it's really individual. So some people will be able to continue having lactose-containing dairy and be okay and be able to manage the symptoms practically with, you know, practical strategies. Others, they might need a period of lactose-free. But it's also really important to note that a lactose intolerance does not mean that you can't have any dairy foods. And often in eating disorders, people will, or the eating disorder, will use that as a form of restriction. So it is really important to challenge. And often what I do in the hospital and in my clinic is that I might do sort of a combination. If having, you know, just dairy foods hasn't been working. So I might switch to a lactose-free milk, but then keep yogurt and cheese in the diet. Really important to try lactose-free products before switching to plant-based, because I know people will just sort of jump to that plant-based alternative straight away. So yeah, it is really individual, but I think absolutely it is so important to re-challenge dairy in the future, because for the majority of people that will revert back to normal once the gut is functioning well.
Yeah, and I think also it's just another restriction that you put on yourself, which in my personal opinion, I think you should try and have as little restriction as possible, as difficult and uncomfortable as it's going to be. Just breaking down every single rule possible is so important to then, you know, you don't want anything holding you back. Another sort of dietary requirement kind of thing that I wanted to ask you about was veganism and vegetarianism, because I think I know a lot of people, especially being vegan during eating disorder recovery, and I think it's a really difficult one to navigate, because a lot of people will say it's for the environment or it's for the animals, and you know, you can't really argue with that if somebody's doing it for that reason. I guess I've got two questions. One, what's your opinion of it during recovery? And I now can't remember the second question. So we'll go with what's your opinion of it during... We'll go for the first question.
So as you said, it is a really difficult area to navigate as an eating disorder dietitian, because more and more people who don't have eating disorders are becoming vegetarian and vegan for ethical and sustainability reasons. And in eating disorder recovery, it can be very difficult to separate the ethical decision to follow a vegan diet versus the eating disorder recovery, eating disorder restriction that's been placed as a way to restrict dietary intake. So it is something that I always challenge. And in my assessment, when I'm, you know, trying to work out what sort of a plan to put people on, it's really important to consider the history, so the length of time that someone has been following a vegan or vegetarian diet. Because if it's something that's new or coincided with the eating disorder starting, then we know that most likely it is going to be an eating disorder-driven decision to restrict food groups. So that's just one thing to think about. And the other is thinking about, can this, you know, recovery, it is possible on a vegan diet, but it is harder because you have to eat a higher volume of foods. And we know that when poor digestion is one of the most common side effects. Having a vegan diet is a very high fiber diet because the protein sources are generally high in fiber, and it can be extremely uncomfortable and really hard to get the amount of energy in that someone needs to restore their health. So it's also looking at someone's individual choices, and if they're able to actually meet the treatment goals following whichever diet they are suggesting that they need to follow. But personally, I very much challenge any vegan labels. And when you think about veganism too, true veganism isn't just about food. It is about, it's a lifestyle choice. So is that person just choosing not to eat animal products? Are they actually implementing veganism in other areas of their life, into skincare, clothing range? Because that's another way to try and separate, is it eating disorder driven or is it for ethical and sustainability reasons?
Yeah, and that was the other question that I had for you, was what would be your advice if somebody is vegan and they think it's solely driven, they do think it's because of the environment, but actually it might be. And I think that's such a good point, because like you say, being vegan is a lifestyle. There's so many things that you have to consider, and I guess that would be quite an easy thing to spot if somebody's just doing it so that, you know, they, when they go to a social occasion, there's no food on offer for them, so then they can't eat. If whether it's that or they're actually like doing all the different aspects of being vegan, I think that's such a good idea to recognize.
Yeah. And I think it's really important too to think about how there are a lot more vegan options now, but it can be limiting in terms of 100% overcoming any food rules that you have if you're following a vegan diet. And so often what I talk to people about is that, you know, can we put the vegan diet on hold for the next short while we focus on recovery and improving your relationship with food? And then once you have a healthy relationship with food in your body, you can then make the decision as to whether you would like to follow a vegetarian or vegan diet again. Because I'm a huge advocate of not placing a label on how we eat. You know, even if you do mostly follow a vegan or vegetarian or pescatarian or whichever diet you choose to follow, unless it's for medical reasons in terms of allergies or diabetes or you know, anything like that, I just think it starts to create food rules. It starts to create some black and white thinking and labels around how you eat and what sort of food choices you have. And I think that part of having a healthy relationship with food is being able to be as spontaneous and flexible as you can be. And so if you're eating out, if you're traveling, if you go over to a friend's or family's house and they're not able to cater for your dietary preferences, which aren't medically needed, then I think it's really important in life to be able to have some flexibility around that. And I always use the example of, you know, if you go over a family member's house and it's someone elderly and they offer you a cup of tea and they don't have almond milk, are you going to say no? Because I think that, you know, we connect over these sorts of occasions, and to me that's more important than having such a rule-bound food label. I just don't think that that's healthy for most people.
Yeah, I love that. That's such a nice thought about would you decline that, because I think most people wouldn't. Well, obviously depending on your mindset. But I also thought it was a really good point you made about the food rules, because, you know, if you are following a vegan diet, there's going to be so many things that you can't have. And, you know, that doesn't then let you have that chance to navigate whether it's actually something that you are fearful of or whether it's actually just, you know, it doesn't follow the sort of diet that you are wanting to, you know, have that lifestyle. And then the final one that I wanted to ask you about, which I think is quite a difficult one to navigate, because and I want to talk about gluten, because obviously for people with celiac, that, you know, that is literally, you cannot have gluten whatsoever, and that, you know, that's a really difficult, I would imagine, that thing to navigate, especially like you're on social occasions and stuff like that. But then obviously people can have gluten intolerances. Is that something that's quite common during eating disorder recovery?
Yes, I don't see it as commonly as lactose intolerance. I mean, I see it as being a eating disorder driven restriction.
Yeah.
Not a medically needed restrictive, dietary restriction. Mm-hmm. So, rightly so, if you are celiac, then of course you need to follow a gluten-free diet. If you are not celiac, and because we know that so many people experience IBS symptoms, we know that some things like gluten or other sort of common trigger foods like onion, for example, or beans might upset someone's gut. And there, a lot of people are driven or, which is scary, have been recommended to go on something like the low FODMAP diet to manage their IBS symptoms, which the number of people I've seen who have gone onto a low FODMAP diet and then eating disorder has spiraled is quite scary. So it's really important not to go on any further elimination diets. If you have an eating disorder or history of disordered eating and you have been recommended the low FODMAP diet, please do not do it on your own. It shouldn't be done alone in general. So really important for anyone who's listening to know that, to please go and seek support from a gut health specialist. But because of those IBS type symptoms, we know that they're a result of being undernourished. For most people, having an undernourished gut, what the general guidelines are is to actually manage the symptoms during those initial stages of refeeding and weight restoration. See if improving the nutritional status of the gut actually helps to reverse the intolerance. And only then, if you've tried everything else, would you recommend potentially looking into something like a low FODMAP diet to test if things like gluten intolerance are a real intolerance or not.
Yeah, I think that's so important what you said about, I was going to say about the low FODMAP diet, because I think I've heard so many people say, I'm going to try it because, you know, I really struggle when I have different types of food and that gives me a load of wind and I get really bloated. And like you say, it's ridiculously dangerous if you're not doing it under supervision, because it is so restrictive. It's so many food rules. And I think that's one thing especially anorexia. Rules and rigidity around food are what anorexia thrives off. So, like you say, it can be so dangerous.
Yeah, absolutely. And also really important to note too that, you know, I've seen people that have been on a low FODMAP diet for about 2 years. It is just meant to be 6 to 8 weeks, and that is it. No longer. So for anyone listening, if you are or know of someone that's following a low FODMAP diet for more than that length of time, then it's really important to go and seek support to reintroduce foods back into your diet, because it is so restrictive and you can miss out on a lot of key nutrients. And we know the number one important thing for gut health is plant-based variety, and a lot of FODMAP foods are plants, so you're just not nourishing your gut when you're on a low FODMAP diet for longer than what's recommended.
And I think that's often what surprises people. It's, you know, often people that engage in these sorts of behaviours will, you know, lean towards the fruits and the vegetables as like their main constituents of their diet. And then they learn about the low FODMAP diet and think, oh, you know, that's another restrictive thing. And then it's like, what? I can't have most of the things I've been having because they have the elements that I'm meant to be cutting out. I think that's a really important thing to note. So thank you so much for chatting with me today. I feel like I've learned so much. This has been such an evidence-based podcast. I feel like I've loved listening to everything you've said. So thank you for bringing all the science and everything, because that is, I love a bit of science.
You're welcome.
The last question that I've been asking all the guests that come onto the podcast, and it's a very, very broad question, so I do apologise, but if someone's listening and they, you know, are thinking, I'd really like to get onto the path of recovery but I'm not sure how, what would be your top tip or best advice for someone to find that motivation?
Speak to someone. I think that often eating disorders are so isolating, and recovery can seem like it can seem like you are the only person in the world that is going through recovery. So I think speak to someone and make connections. And there are some incredible recovery communities out there now. And I think just knowing that you're not alone and having the support from friends and family can make the world of difference, because part of eating disorder recovery is opening your life back to all the joys and experiences which often come about with social connections. Mm-hmm. So that would be probably my number one tip.
Yeah. Perfect. Well, thank you so much, Talia. I have really, like I said, I've really enjoyed chatting with you today.
You're welcome. Thank you so much for having me.
I enjoyed that episode with Talia so much. I think understanding the science behind our body when we're in recovery is so important, because we can then understand why things are happening in our body and the process, and to know that it's not forever. I also love that we went into detail with different dietary choices during eating disorder recovery and the considerations that you need to make. Next week, we'll be joined by Jess Griffiths, who is the clinical lead at BEAT. This was a really exciting conversation for me, speaking to the UK's largest charity, and we also touched on Jess's personal experience of having an eating disorder and how she likes to be open and honest in order to help other people who are struggling with their eating disorder.
Drives that perfectionism. So if I was to put it out there and say, oh, I never struggle, that's not fair on everyone I'm supporting, you know. What I just try and be real, you know, in a sense, I've got nothing to hide, you know, but I think it is helpful to hear that to struggle is normal. And I think, like I say, as a mum, I'm conscious of what I model to them. Mm-hmm. And they need to see the reality of life and how to navigate those emotions and those various different challenges.
If you enjoyed listening today, you won't want to miss next week's episode. So be sure to subscribe to be one of the first to hear it. Please also like, comment and share this podcast with anyone you feel that may need support at the moment. Not only those struggling with eating disorders, but also their loved ones, as this can be a very difficult time for everyone. Eating disorders are crippling illnesses, and this podcast aims to motivate and inspire individuals along their path of recovery. If you are struggling with an eating disorder, charities like BEAT, SEED and First Steps have great resources. Please also reach out to your local GP to see how you can gain support for your eating disorder. See you next time. Bye!